Both at home and in church, prayers were read out of a book. And she didn't feel they were very, therefore, very genuine. And as a child, she tells how she struggled to learn how to pray in reality. And she heard a sermon read which had the text in it, "Pray without ceasing." A text in the New Testament which has affected other people. There's a famous Russian mystical book based on that particular problem. How do you pray without, you know that, do you? Or you've heard of it? It's very interesting that, that for a child of six, maybe, she says she could hardly read when these problems came to her. She wondered what it meant to pray without ceasing. And then also, she wondered if there wasn't a realer way of praying and making up your own prayers instead of reading and reciting. And she tells how, as time went on, as she distressed at her dissatisfaction with the whole thing, she began writing her own prayers out. One night when she went to bed, she wrote out a very short prayer. And next morning, she read that prayer to herself. That seemed to her more personal and real. Now, near home, 3 or 4 miles away, there was a group of people, I'm not quite sure what, but they were nonconformists. And there was a service there, and she found out about it. And she slipped over to it. She got a little bit older. Without any of the family going, or without their approving of her going, but one of the maids felt incumbent upon her to follow her and to see that she came to no harm. And this minister certainly didn't go as far as Quakerism in his freedom from the Anglican service. But he did have two prayers in the service, and one of them was his own voluntary prayer, as you know many ministers do today. The prayer that they've either written or recite spontaneously for the occasion. He also, and I suppose this kept him in his job, used the prayer book as well for one prayer. And she went over there and learned something about spontaneous prayer that way. Well, it's an interesting account, much of it quoted in here, of the experience of a small girl in this sober religious atmosphere. You might say morbid and premature, but that was the kind of England she lived in. And then as she grew up, she continued this freedom and finally at a quite young age, 19 I think, she married Sir William Springett. Now, Sir William Springett actually was the son of the household where she'd been boarding, the relatives, or that's the parents' relatives, and so that they had known each other for a good many years when they married. And Madam Springett, who was the boss of the household, was so strict about little Mary's religion. On the other hand, I was very fond of her personally, and was very approved very much of the marriage. So I think it was in every way a love match, and this man was also somewhat enfranchised from the, or free from the conventional religious point of view. And when they were married, they refused to use the ring, which was regarded as by the separatists as a remnant of papacy and a mark of paganism, really. And so they were married without a ring. That caused quite a stir in the community. In fact, her whole behavior, of course, was in the community in which her about her, most of them. Happily, one or two of the maids were sympathetic and went with her or read to her sermons of a nonconformist minister. She usually read two sermons in the afternoon and went to church twice and heard two sermons. This is Sunday, at least, kind of grim day, but no grimmer than for other people. And the rest of the day, she was very careful not to spend any extra time on food or clothing, because she thought she ought to put the whole day in religious life. Their first child was named John, and apparently died before the second one was born. Meanwhile, her husband, whom she describes as a little girl, watching this older boy in the home, very lively fellow, and full of ability, she admired. When he couldn't go outdoors and engage in target practice and so on, he would do things in the house which she could watch, take the clock apart and put it together and mend it, and all kinds of ingenious things. There's a human touch about this girl's reminiscences of her husband long before they were married. Well, he was involved in the war, the Civil War, which broke out in 42. And as you see, 44, he died. He took part in several engagements and was wounded in one, and at Arundel in Kent, again, where the Parliamentary Army, where he was fighting in the Parliamentary Army, he became very ill. And there's the most poignant account that she gives of his illness and death. She was allowed to be with him, but he thought he was contagious, and she was expecting a second child, and she came and went to his bedside, and finally was kept away entirely, and he died. With his anticipation, the funeral again was not the regular elation type of funeral. Some of the superstitions, that as they seemed to them, of ordinary funerals were avoided. And this is the end of their married life, a very brief, entirely happy one and congenial. Awfully hard for a person of her social status to find a religious person of her class. She says that she rejected all other suitors and that her people told her that she never would find a person who was religiously in sympathy with her, and that she'd better marry somebody who wasn't. When she went off to this local church, the family said she went there just so she could meet some men, and well, you can imagine kind of things that would be said. But actually, this worked out pretty well, except that he died very young. He was on the parliamentary side and had already given not only his services and finally his life, but a good deal of money to support it. And when he died, she found he was bankrupt. However, she contributed some of her own property. She was an heiress, as you see, and paid off debts. And then she had, as a young mother now, with a second child, Guglielma Maria. We don't just know how early John died, but certainly didn't live very long. Here's a widow and child, kind of stranded. She went to London, lived there for a while, and meanwhile, her daughter grew up. And finally, in 54, 10 years after her first husband's death, she married Isaac Pennington. Neither of these people you see were Quakers, but they were what we call seekers. Isaac Pennington, a man of good background and culture, college graduate, his father having experiences in the Civil War, I mean political experiences on two sides of that, moved in the best society. It may be harder for people that live and move in the best society to adjust themselves to this kind of religious sensitivity. It may be harder for them than it is for just common farmers and shopkeepers. At any rate, Mary and Isaac were seekers when they were married and continued so for some years. Perhaps I should say that there was a period in Mary's life between the time of her husband's death and the birth of her daughter and the time she met Isaac Pennington, where she became very frivolous, she says. Now, what she means by being frivolous may be rather exaggerated, you know, from her later point of view. But at any rate, she felt as though her whole religious interest of her childhood had vanished, and she was just kind of lost and entertained herself in frivolous ways. They married and moved into an area in Buckinghamshire, where Isaac Pennington had an estate. And, while they were there, they had their first contact with Quakers.